Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire moose and loons. Their images adorn t-shirts, mugs, the signs of gift shops and country inns. Tours aimed at spotting them are popular, and for visitors and locals alike, they symbolize what makes our wild places special. But these creatures are struggling, and this hour in The Exchange, we look at how and why, also at efforts to support them, some requiring just a little extra attention, others pretty controversial. We begin our conversation with the plight of the moose, and of course, your observations and questions are welcome. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. For this segment of our program, we have two guests. David Patrick is here, Director of Conservation for the Nature Conservancy in New Hampshire. And David, welcome. Good to see you.
Hi, Laura.
Also with us, Christine Rhines, Moose Project Leader for New Hampshire Fish and Game. And Chris, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having me here.
So, David, why are moose important?
So moose are one of these sort of keystone species that really help to shape our environment, both from sort of an ecological standpoint. I'd also say from kind of the character of New Hampshire and the region. I mean, they're one of these iconic species. So moose play an incredibly important role as a browser. So they browse our forest, and that helps to shape the structure of the forest. The tree species that they browse, obviously, you know, the ones they like, you know, we see changes in those, and the ones that they don't like, we see an increase in those as well. But I think, you know, when we look at moose from that iconic status, you know, here in New Hampshire, I mean, this is a place where, you know, when people come to New Hampshire, they want to see moose. You know, they're excited to see them here, and I mean, I get excited to see moose as well. And so I, you know, both from that ecological standpoint and from that sort of cultural standpoint, they're really one of our, you know, of our keystone species.
Well, it's interesting what you said, and I've thought a lot about them, obviously, as a, you know, we're excited to see them. Tourists love to see them. Lots of North Country economics rely on people seeing moose or being excited about moose. But talk a little bit more, if you could, David, about the ecological impact, you know, what moose eat and where they live and how that has an impact on everything else.
Yeah, certainly. So I think if you've been out in the North Country and in areas where, you know, where there are a good number of moose still, you see that effect on the landscape. So you see what we call the browse line. And for moose, that's pretty high up. You know, these creatures can get high up into, you know, up into the forest. And there are certain tree species that moose and deer love to eat, you know, and things like our sugar maples. Sadly, some of the trees that we also like to grow. And on the flip side, you know, we have other tree species that we think of as, you know, non-preferred browse. And a classic one there is our American beech. And so American beech is a tree that, you know, where we have intensive browsing is a tree you'll see a lot more of. And conversely, you know, where we have a lot of browsing, you'll see less of, you know, these other trees. There's also been some really interesting research showing that browsing can actually be really beneficial to a number of species. So we have a small shrubby species called witch hobble bush that it's easy to miss in the forest there, but it's, you know, the moose love it. And when they browse it, that shrub tends to grow and branch out more, and that creates great habitat for our ground nesting birds as well. So that's just one example of how they can really help to shape the environment, shape the forest in ways that, you know, has benefits certainly to wildlife. And obviously, you know, for foresters sometimes, well, maybe they'd like to see a little bit more sugar maple regenerating.
Yeah, so it's all connected. How would you answer that question, Chris? Why are moose important? Beyond the thrill of seeing one by the side of the road, why should we care about them?
So I would agree with Dave. They certainly can shape the forest. We've done a lot of studies on moose browsing, and we're not seeing really very big impacts. Our densities just aren't high enough. But we are seeing enough so that moose are able to maintain kind of a shrubby environment where they overwinter in larger numbers. And that's very helpful. We need young forest in order for an enormous number of our mammalian and bird species to do well. But aside from that, really right now, I think moose are our canary in the coal mine. They are the species that is telling us, you know, climate change is real. It is happening here in the Granite State, and it's impacting our wildlife. They are kind of like the precursor. They are telling us things are changing, and they're changing fairly dramatically. And moose is really helping us to recognize that.
Well, it's interesting because sometimes these canary in a coal mine species are small, you know, a certain frog or a certain insect. But in this case,
hard to miss the moose.
Yeah, hard to miss the moose. And you've been involved, Chris, in this major multi-year study of New Hampshire's moose. So what are you finding?
So we've been working on this project really since 2001 with Dr. Peter Pekins out of UNH. And what we are finding is that as our winters grow shorter, and they have grown shorter by about 3 weeks, moose are becoming much more susceptible to parasites, whether it's brainworm or winter tick. These parasites are causing our moose to decline. And as things continue to change and our winters grow even more short, that is going to be increasingly problematic. So we did recently find that drought, actually, the drought that we had last late summer and early fall was very beneficial because it killed a lot of those ticks as they were questing to get on moose. So whether we have a lot of drought in the future or we have what they are predicting, which is more like a lot of rain, increase in rain, it will really tell us how much longer we might be able to hold on to a species that is perfectly designed for cold weather.
We've talked a lot on this program about the black-legged tick that carries, you know, Lyme disease and other diseases like brucellosis. What's a winter tick? Is that different?
It is different. If I were to put an adult winter tick and an adult deer tick or any I certainly couldn't tell the difference, but they are very different. Their lifestyle is very different. So winter tick, when they hatch, which they do in late summer, all of those nymphs climb up onto vegetation. So there will be hundreds of nymphs questing all together, and they link legs. And they are designed, they actually quest at the perfect height to get on a deer, which is their primary host, or a moose. And so they're questing at a time when deer and moose are most active, which is during the breeding season. And once they get on their host, they stay on them for their entire life cycle. So they go from nymph to larva to adult, taking 3 blood meals as they do so. And for moose, they evolved in the cold. They're not used to ectoparasites. They have very poor grooming habits, kind of like teenage boys. So they don't, you know, they don't remove these parasites. And they will have literally tens of thousands of ticks on them, feeding on them in the wintertime, and basically causing severe anemia and eventually death in the spring.
So why is it called a winter tick then, when sometimes we hear if it's a really cold winter, they die out?
So it's not the cold, because they're on the moose once winter comes.
I see.
It is the length of winter. So because our winters, we don't really get snow now until late December, those ticks continue to quest, and more ticks get on moose until you get permanent snowfall on the ground.
Because they are on vegetation, and once that vegetation is covered with snow, they can't do their business anymore.
Correct, yep.
I see. And the other thing that seems different, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, regular ticks, you know, sort of one at a time, they
correct.
Jump on, they get their blood meal. These ticks jump on as a group and stay on.
Stay on. Yeah, they are there. They are on the moose all winter long.
It's interesting to hear you also talk about how moose are maladapted to this change, not their fault, but they don't have the grooming habits that, you know, deer have and some other mammals have who, you know, they feel a tick and they groom it off.
Right. So they evolved in the far north where there were no ectoparasites. So they don't know that they should remove these things. So they allow them to stay on them. There have been some studies that suggest that once they've been severely impacted, they try to avoid the ticks, but they really have no instinct to groom. So unlike most other species that evolve, you know, either in the more southern areas or in the more middle portions of our continent, moose evolved far to the north and they don't understand grooming.
Any surprises here, David, for you from an ecological perspective?
No, I mean, you know, what we're seeing with moose is really sort of a pattern that we're seeing with many other species as well. I mean, when we think about climate change and the impacts for biodiversity, we often sort of assume that it's what we call a direct impact. You know, it gets too hot and the organism simply can't survive. And there are cases where that's true. You know, our brook trout being a good example, you know, they have a low critical thermal maxima. The water gets too warm and they simply can't survive. But more often what we see is these indirect effects. So moose being a great example where, in this case, you know, we have a warmer climate, a shorter winter, and that facilitates, you know, the parasite, the ectoparasite here. And there are, you know, countless other examples as well of this maladaption where organisms adapted to the cold, you know, through these indirect pathways, you know, can be influenced in often unforeseen ways. And it really is challenging from a management standpoint to preempt, you know, to understand what's going to happen, and, you know, until they actually does, because you can't foresee every possible eventuality.
How much worse off, David, are New Hampshire's moose than moose north of us, you know, Maine or Canada? Because from what I understand, we're in the southern range for moose.
Yeah, so I'll kick this off and certainly look to Chris as our moose expert here. But we are seeing, you know, we're seeing issues for moose across the southern edge of their range. And this pattern, again, is sort of common for southern range edge populations of a variety of species. So here in New Hampshire, we're on this ecotone, and we have a number of species where their southern range extent comes down into the state. And a lot of those populations really are struggling. And if you think about it, there's a reason that those are southern range edge populations. You know, there's a reason they don't extend further south. And so what we assume is that they're up against some kind of threshold. You know, and above that threshold or below that threshold, they can't make it. So if you have a change in the environment on those range edge populations, there's a good chance it's going to push them over the brink, you know, over that threshold. And you'll see those local populations wink out. Further into the range, we assume that, you know, things are better. Those, you know, you're sort of further away from those thresholds. And so if you have a perturbation, a change in the environment, it's more likely you're going to be able to withstand that.
What have you seen in Maine or Canada, Chris?
So we're actually, the study that we're doing, we are doing in concert with both Maine and Vermont so that we can better understand how changing environmental factors will influence moose. And in fact, Maine has two study sites, one very far north and one more in line with our own. And their site further north, the moose are doing fine. And in fact, it's interesting because I'm going to a moose conference in Nova Scotia, and their primary discussion is going to be about very high moose densities. And in fact, we are seeing moose doing very well in further north in Canadian provinces, the Yukon, Alaska, and northern Scandinavia. But even in southern Scandinavia, moose are starting to have issues with parasites. So far north, where winter still is strong, these northern species are doing fine. But on the southern edge of their range, they are not going to do well.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, we're looking at moose and a little bit later, loons, two species, both beloved as symbols of what makes our wild places special and both struggling. We're finding out why and we're looking at efforts to save them here in the state. You can join us with your comments, questions, and of course your own observations. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So Mitch on Facebook asks, what were moose populations like before European contact? And Mitch says, how does that compare to today? Now, Chris, this is important because there's been a lot of conversation about how when we look at the number of moose today, you know, we say, oh, that's terrible. But then, you know, maybe years back, there were even fewer moose than what we have today. So I'd love your thoughts on those numbers. And Mitch, thanks for the question.
So pre-European contact, there were no wildlife biologists to count moose. So we really can't tell you a number. But we can tell you that when Europeans first colonized our state, they described moose as existing throughout our state. Their numbers were declining as you went from north to south. The lowest densities were found around the seacoast, just like it is today. But they were found in large enough numbers so people could use them as a primary source of both food and clothing. So moose were here. What the densities were, we do not know.
And then, what was it, 20 years ago, we had 7,000-ish moose, Chris, and now we have 4,000-ish. Help me out with those numbers.
Yeah, so we had about 7,000. Now we've got about 3,500. Some of that decline was purposeful. Some people in our northern regions asked for fewer moose due to the problems with moose vehicle collisions. But the bulk of this decline has been due to parasite loads.
You know, when we talk about the struggles of the moose and the ticks has obviously been a huge story. There's also, though, David, the issue of habitat. And this comes up with other species that when our houses or our stores or our industrial parks are built, even if these projects are small, you know, it doesn't seem like it's taking up that much space. It does break up animals' space to roam. What's the solution there, David, between people building what they want to build and animals having the room that they need?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, obviously we want to see economic development in the state. I mean, we all recognize that. And we have communities, particularly up north, that are struggling. And it really comes down to you know, development in the right places, and for the conservation groups, for our wildlife biologists to be working with our towns, our communities, to help them understand how can you continue to grow your community, how can you build in a way that doesn't fragment our habitat, you know, as much as possible, that, you know, where we're not putting houses in areas that, you know, are important for wildlife and are important for us as well, you know, so putting a house in somewhere where it might be important as a source of drinking water. So there's a lot of opportunities there for us to work together. You know, when we think about the changes in the habitat, you know, it comes down to three things. So habitat loss, so, you know, a reduction in the area of our habitat. Habitat fragmentation, as you just alluded to, so that's a breaking of one's continuous pieces into smaller, more isolated patches. And there's obviously an issue there, you know, that we have smaller populations, there may not be enough room for our wide-ranging species. And then we have the risk that when an organism, you know, a moose or anything else is traveling from one place to another, they're often encountering roadways, and then we had the issues with you know, vehicle wildlife collision. Nobody wants to see that. So there are opportunities for us to work together, and you know, with our wildlife action plan here in New Hampshire, and we've got some great resources to help us figure out how do we do this well.
Is it about zoning, David? Is it about, you know, building those wildlife corridors that I saw in Alberta, Canada last year? I mean, what is it?
Yeah, so it's sort of all of the above. So certainly zoning is a great approach, you know, for us to really plan ahead and think, you know, proactively about how we develop. Here in New Hampshire, we actually have, in a lot of the state, we have a wonderful situation. You know, we see those corridors, and there are places in the state where we need them. But we also have, you know, incredible intact landscape up north. And I think that's something we should celebrate. We're a part of the largest contiguous block of broadleaf forest probably in the world. You know, this is our untold story here in New Hampshire. Extends right up through Canada, out into New York, through Maine. And you know, we want to hold on to that. You know, the seacoast, it's a different story. Obviously, there we might be looking at piecing together existing fragments.
All right, we'll talk more in just a moment. And Chris, I'm going to ask you about a proposal that's sort of being whispered about, whether increasing the moose hunt would actually help the moose. We will follow up after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This week on the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, author Michael Cunningham has advice we can all take to heart, no matter what you do.
You have to figure out when it's time to just let it go, when this is all you can do. Over the years, I have developed a slightly better sense of when I've reached that point, when in rewriting, I'm not making it better, but I'm just making it different.
Subscribe to the podcast for sage advice or find some at nhpr.org/10mww.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, a two-part show. First, New Hampshire's moose, their struggles and talk of a controversial plan to help them. Then we'll turn to another popular species, the loon. We'd love to hear from you, of course, your questions, comments, personal observations are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. David Patrick is with us for the hour, Director of Conservation for the Nature Conservancy here in New Hampshire. Christine Rhines is with us, Moose Project Leader for New Hampshire Fish and Game. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So both of you, Chris, you first, some biologists are starting to talk about a possible solution to the moose's struggles with the ticks, that they admit would be unpopular with a large segment of the public, and that is increasing the moose hunt to help the moose recover. Now, Chris, this seems counterintuitive, so can you explain?
So it wouldn't so much help moose recover, but it would certainly reduce the incidence of ticks on the moose that are here. What we do know about winter tick is it is absolutely tied to moose density. So the higher moose densities you have, the more severe the problem with ticks is going to be in the face of climate change with shorter winters, allowing ticks to get on them to begin with. So fewer moose would reduce tick loads on moose. It would reduce the high impacts to calves. Not so many would die, these horrible tick-laden deaths. It would increase cow productivity. They would become healthier and be able to produce more calves. So in order to keep moose at those low densities, you would actually have to increase eventually the hunt, because you wouldn't want the densities to increase further. Whether that decision was made to try that or not would really be up to the general public. We currently have goals in place at which point we will stop issuing permits for the different regions in the state, and those goals are set by the general public every 10 years.
And that trajectory is already on target, right? Each year we've gone down in terms of the amount of moose hunting licenses.
Correct. So whether we decide to do that or not remains to be seen. It would require a huge public education effort and further study, really. In fact, Maine is hoping to try this on one of their regions. So we'll see how things sugar off. But it's important that people understand this is not going to cause moose to recover. You're going to have to maintain these much lower moose densities. So you may be able to hold moose a little bit longer on the landscape, but if things continue to change, if we continue to have shorter and shorter winters, there comes a point where moose simply can't exist in an environment that is so dramatically changed, which climate change is bringing to us.
No, I'm not a biologist. So for me, it's hard to understand how fewer moose would mean fewer ticks on the moose that remain, given the habits of the ticks that you described earlier. They hang out on the vegetation and they wait for the moose to come by and then they all jump on in one big group. So I don't know how those tick habits would change if there were fewer moose.
So what happens, if all you have is white-tailed deer, deer groom. So when the ticks get on the deer, they groom the majority of them off, thereby killing them. Moose don't do that.
Right.
They let all the ticks live. So the more moose you have, the more ticks survive and survive for the following year.
And
so
they reproduce.
You get more and more ticks on the landscape, higher and higher numbers of ticks, more and more ticks questing each fall as your moose densities remain high. So if you continue to have shorter winters, allowing ticks to get on moose to begin with, moose density is the primary mover of tick density. And the only way to reduce tick density is to reduce moose density.
Whenever we talk about this, David, we get calls from people saying, what about giving the moose the same anti-tick protection that we give our pets? What about letting guinea hens loose in the woods? They eat ticks. I found out recently on this program that possums are great tick eaters. What about those ideas?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, we have these options sort of put forward, and the question for us is, and for our management agency, obviously in particular, is, you know, are they really feasible, and how conservation dependent do we, you know, can these species really become? We talk about this concept of conservation dependent, where we have species that can no longer persist in the landscape without direct intervention by us, by our managers on a yearly basis, and we, you know, there's a long list. Our tern species are a good example on our islands. And with the moose, you know, this iconic wide-ranging species, and I think as Chris just outlined, you know, looking forward, it's difficult to see a long-term positive future for moose here in New Hampshire. And, you know, releasing guinea hens, you know, short-term, you know, intense management, you know, maybe, but in the long term, you know, really, I think that ultimately we need to address the issues, the fundamental drivers of climate change. And until we do that, many of our species are going to follow the path of the moose here in New Hampshire.
Well, addressing the broader issue of climate change, you know, big, huge, difficult global treaties, you know, politics and so forth. Right here on the ground, right now, in terms of the moose, are you questioning, David, whether it's worth it, intensive management?
No, I think we absolutely have to, you know, this is a personal view. I'd say we're morally obliged to do everything we can to conserve our species here in New Hampshire. And there are things we can do. So habitat management, you know, if you've got a species, a population that's struggling, well, we can work to improve other aspects of the environment in ways that bolster that population. So they, in the case of moose, for example, they're facing these challenges with ticks. But if, you know, if other aspects of the habitat, if there's a lot of browse available, for example, well, that's a way that we can improve things. And we'll be talking about loons where, you know, similarly, we can and have done a lot to, you know, through active management to try and promote, you know, the health of these populations. So certainly I'm not suggesting in any way that these efforts are not warranted. But I think we do have to face up to the long-term, you know, the long-term reality of where things are headed.
Well, speaking of long-term reality, Zachariah on Twitter told us this morning, he says, it seems the way things are going that moose crossing signs will be historical curiosities in 20 years, like settlers' cabins or log flumes. Zachariah, thank you for the comment. It's pretty sad. What do you think, Chris?
So I don't know if 20 years is accurate, but if things continue the way that climate scientists are predicting they will, then yes, New Hampshire will eventually be a state where moose simply cannot survive. We're going to lose a lot of the species that they browse on. It's simply going to get too warm. And there, more and more parasites will become able to survive here. And moose, as we know, don't deal very well with parasites. So yeah, things are going to change fairly dramatically for us here.
What's the next step for you, Chris? As I understand, you're in the final year of wrapping up this multi-year study on the moose.
Yes. So after this, really, it's a question of public education and helping people to understand the ramifications of what is happening for moose and how that relates to ourselves and what we can do about it. And really, as Dave said, the most important things that we can do are protect open space, make sure there's plenty of young forests so that moose can be distributed across the landscape, thereby somewhat reducing their densities, and really doing all we can to, in our own lives, to reduce the impacts of climate change.
Well, Chris, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Christine Rhines, Moose Project Leader for New Hampshire Fish and Game. We turn now to the other species that for many Granite Staters really represents the call of the wild. The common loon, with its black body, red eye, and ghostly cries, loons are as eagerly sought out as moose, and like moose, their populations are threatened. But loons have also benefited from the work of hundreds of volunteers who go to great lengths to help their nests succeed. We turn now to New Hampshire's loons, and David Patrick of the Nature Conservancy is still with us. We also welcome now Harry Vogel. He's director of the Loon Preservation Committee. And Harry, it's great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for having me on to talk about loons.
So how important are loons to New Hampshire?
Boy, I think that loons, like moose, are another iconic species. I think it's critical to many people's conception and experience of New Hampshire to hear that call in the night, to see those black and white birds bobbing on the lakes, hopefully with some chicks or on a nest at the water's edge. So I think it's hard to overestimate the importance of these birds.
You know, David told us earlier not just the sort of social and cultural importance, but also that moose, anyway, the way they browse, it creates habitat for other animals that turns out, lo and behold, is special for those other animals. What about loons? Do they have an ecological role here in New Hampshire that you can see, Harry?
Absolutely. I think loons really, they're a sentinel of environmental quality. They're an indicator of the health of our lakes and ponds. And so as a top-level predator on these aquatic food webs, if you have loons, and especially breeding loons, successful loons, that's an indicator that something is right in our environment. And conversely, if you have these birds beginning to disappear or not being able to reproduce, as was the case in the early 1900s and through to the mid-1900s, that's an indicator that something is amiss.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us as well as we talk about loons, your observations, your questions, comments, concerns, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Harry, how did our rainy spring and rainy early summer, including some pretty heavy downpours around the 1st of July, end of June, how did those affect loons?
Yeah, it's been a challenging year for loons so far. So I heard that we had the fourth wettest spring in the past 100 years, and that means that the ground was very saturated with water. And when those storms ran through, all that water ran right off into our lakes. And loons, being a species that nests right at the water's edge, they are susceptible to those wet years and especially to those storm events. And we did lose a number of nests just due to washing out.
They nest right by the water's edge then, not on land by the water, but actually right in the little coves, right, Harry, where it's safe.
Generally, they're creating a nest that is mud and any kind of aquatic or land-based vegetation, and just forming that into a bowl right next to the water.
I'd love your thoughts too, David, on the idea that, in addition to warm temperatures, rain is an impact that we're told we might see more of, a lot of rain all at once, and that's problematic.
Yeah, so this issue, you know, we talk about it sort of an increased frequency and severity of these severe events, and really what that means is we're going to see they're going to happen more often, and at least some of them are going to be even more extreme, even drier or even wetter than we've seen before. And this really is an issue for our wildlife populations. You know, the analogy I use here is sort of a boxing match. You know, so if you have, you know, your severe event, you know, your one punch that comes in, oh, you know, every 100 years, well, then you've got time to recover from that. But if it's, you know, one blow after another, you know, a really wet year, a really dry year, then what we start seeing is these populations getting knocked down, you know, getting unable to recover. And that really is the issue there. You know, we've always had extreme severe, you know, weather events, but there's a reason it's called a 100-year storm. And when your 100-year storm is occurring, you know, every 4 or 5 years, then all of a sudden you can see that those impacts are much more severe and that we have the potential to start really losing our populations.
So it's almost like, the human body, if you have one illness, sometimes you're more likely to capture another one just because you're weak. You haven't had a chance to recover. It's the same thing.
That's exactly it. You know, we talk about sort of chronic stress, you know, and both the examples of moose and loon are good, you know, a great way of illustrating this. You know, if we have moose that have got parasites, well, they're more susceptible to other things. You know, with our loons, if we've got you know, nests that are getting underwater, and you've got populations that are, you know, in lakes where we may be seeing lakeshore development. Again, these things interact with one another.
You know, Harry, when we talked about the moose, one of the things we learned was that they are, again, not their fault, but they're maladapted to some of these stressors. They don't groom off the ticks, for example, like some other species do. Deer can walk around with brainworm and they're fine. Moose, you know, they die from brainworm. What about loons? Are there certain aspects of this species that makes them vulnerable to stressors that another bird might be able to shrug off?
Yes. So loons are a northern species. Here at New Hampshire, they're very close to the southern edge of their range. So their physiology is really meant to retain heat rather than distribute heat. And typically, so a loon's feet are highly vascularized. So you can think of it almost like an elephant's ear. There's a lot of blood going through there, and there's an easy way then for loons that are in the water to lose excess heat. The problem comes when they jump out of the water to sit on a nest. And at that point, they lose a lot of their ability to lose that heat, and loons will suffer. And so peak of nesting, of nest initiation for loons is about June 1st. So peak of hatch is right around July 4th. And that in itself is unfortunate.
Oh, bad
for these
timing.
Birds.
That's a busy time on our waterways,
it
right?
It is. But it also means that all of that black plumage is soaking up a lot of heat while loons are on the nest. And so loons will pant, much like a dog or a cat, to rid themselves of excess heat. And we have seen loons panting on the nest at temperatures as low as 75 degrees. And so they're already heat stressed at that point. When you get into 80, 90 degrees and that hot sun bearing down on them, loons can really suffer on that nest.
So they don't adapt, or they don't expel heat as easily as other
as many other
creatures,
birds.
Partly because of that black plumage, and partly because when they're on the nest, they're not paddling around, and that's where they release excess heat. They store too much heat
yes.
internally.
Yes.
That's super interesting. I'd never heard that before. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more thing that I read, Harry, about, you know, again, loons not being as well adapted to extreme changes. They don't have that many chicks. They're not producing, you know, multiple nests year after year after year.
Right. Yeah. So what we've learned through banding so that we can recognize individual loons and begin to follow them over their lifetimes is that loons don't even start to breed on average until they're 5 or 6 years old. We followed some loons that were 10 or 11 years old before they began to breed, and then they lay at most 2 eggs. And so the typical or average breeding success in New Hampshire is about a half a chick per pair per year. And that really does limit our ability to recover that species. So one of the things that we've learned is when loons are gone from an area, it's really hard to get them back. And it's been a slow process to rebuild those populations.
David, what else is bothering the loons?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, you know, one of our major concerns obviously is our lakeshore development, you know, where we have, we have increasing numbers of houses, we have increasing boat traffic on those waters. And obviously that, you know, we've all seen it, that disturbs the loons. And we talked, you know, some of that disturbance can be fatal disturbance, obviously, if you have a bird that's injured or killed. But also, you know, some of it's that chronic stress as well, you know, birds that might be trying to forage and instead they're dodging motorboats. We have, you know, the issue of lead that is so familiar, and I know, you know, Harry can talk in more depth about that as well. And you know, as we referenced, you know, at the beginning of the discussion of loons, you know, this iconic species that, you know, the call of the wild. Well, I think we all have a sense, you know, many of the members of the general public, of where you tend to hear that call. And you're not seeing it, you know, in our lakes where you've got a lot of development. You're still seeing it in places that have that wild sense to them, that wild signature. And I think it, you know, from a general standpoint, that gives you a sense of sort of what are we talking about when we're looking at good habitat. We have some emerging threats as well. I mean, we're finding chemicals in our lakes, you know, flame retardants, for example. You know, our lakes are not going to set on fire. We shouldn't be finding flame retardant chemicals in our water.
A lot more to talk about after a short break. And we'll look at some of the huge efforts that volunteers for the Loon Preservation Committee have made to rescue some of these nests that Harry talked about. Your comments and questions are welcome. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today, for the love of loons, a lot of people in this state are trying to help loons out. And as we're hearing, these birds need the help with their numbers on our biggest lakes declining. Let's get your questions, comments, and personal observations of loons in our state. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. David Patrick is here, Director of Conservation for the Nature Conservancy in New Hampshire, along with Harry Vogel, Director of the Loon Preservation Committee. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And Harry, just before the break, David mentioned lead sinkers from fishermen. Didn't New Hampshire ban those more than a decade ago?
Yes. And so this has been a gradual process. So we've gone back to the legislature several times because of the impacts of lead sinkers and lead-headed fishing jigs on common loons. And the last step or the last phase in that happened back in 2013. And at that point, we realized that although we had restricted the sale and use of lead sinkers that were 1 ounce in size or less, and those are the types most often ingested by loons.
Smaller ones. The loons eat.
Exactly.
And then they're poisonous and they die.
Right, exactly. And so, but the standard for the lead-headed jigs, which is just a sinker that's molded around a fishing hook, was less than an inch, including the hook. And that was not at all a protective standard. So we're continuing to see many loon deaths from ingesting these larger lead-headed jigs. And so our effort in 2013 was to go back and say, rather than have this confusing standard where it's a weight standard for sinkers and a length standard for jigs, let's just have one protective standard and say that anything, a lead sinker or a lead-headed jig is illegal for use or sale in New Hampshire if it's 1 ounce or less. So those sizes need to be made of other non-toxic materials. And there are a huge number of materials that you can make those out of.
Well, given how toxic we now know lead is, not just to loons, but, you know, anything, basically, why do we even allow lead at all? Why can't we just say, no more lead?
Yeah. Well, we went to the legislature. The unfortunate thing, really, is that this was seen as a loon issue. And we knew at that point that, as in so many other things, loons had found themselves at the focal point of this particular environmental issue, simply because they're scientifically important and they have this wide public appeal. And so people care about these birds. But the reality is we know of a couple of dozen species here in New Hampshire that have actually swallowed lead sinkers and lead-headed jigs and subsequently died of lead poisoning. So we are advancing this on behalf of many species. The problem was that the legislature at the time saw this as a loon only species, because that's the species that we have the most data on. And the sinkers and jigs that we found in loons were all of around 1 ounce or less in size. And so that is as much as high as the legislature was willing to go.
So that was the compromise. But now where does this stand?
Well, now we're at that standard, which we think is actually a very protective standard. And the reality is that most of the sinkers and jigs that are used in freshwater do fall into that 1 ounce or less category. And so often when you're getting into larger sinkers or jigs, these are more for ocean fishing, things of that nature. And so so we actually think this is pretty good.
You know, Harry, David talked about boats earlier, and I want a couple questions about boats. It's easy to see how a loon nest might be disturbed by a large wake from a large motorboat. What about smaller watercraft? What about kayaks and canoes?
Sure. And it's often the kayaks or canoes that are traveling to a small island that is likely to be used by a nesting loon, or bumping their way along the shoreline, just looking at things of interest. And in that case, it's easy to suddenly come around a corner, surprise a loon, and flush that bird off the nest. And the good news here is that if you turn around and leave the area right away, if that happens, the chances are pretty good that a loon is going to get back on that nest within 20 or 30 minutes. The danger is that if it's a really hot day, those eggs can cook on the nest. And if it's a cold and rainy day, the embryo inside of those eggs can chill. Either one of those can kill the embryo developing inside of the eggs. And it also leaves that untended nest exposed to anything working its way along the shoreline, looking for an easy meal or flying overhead.
Muskrat, eagle, whatever. Wow, it's really delicate. I had no idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we lose a number of nests to human disturbance every year.
I'd love to ask you, too, about kayaks and canoes, David, and especially if you've ever had that experience yourself where you're innocently kayaking along and all of a sudden you see a loon.
Yeah, I think it's one of the challenges. I mean, you know, we're often out in our kayaks and canoes to see things like loons. I mean, that's why we're out on the water, because it's such an incredible place to be. And I think, you know, certainly I've had that experience. I've tried to follow the advice that Harry just offered. You know, I turn around and I move away and sort of maintain a safe distance. And but I think, you know, one of the things we're learning, you know, as we do more research, is that, you know, activities like hiking that we think of as not having much in the way of impact, well, they do. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't be out hiking. It doesn't mean we shouldn't be out in canoes and kayaks enjoying the environment. But with a little bit of education, you know, we can do so in a responsible way.
So if you see that loon in your canoe, back off. The temptation is, you know what I'm going to say, David, to pull out the camera and go, cool, I'm going to get a great picture of a loon.
Well, you know, maybe you can have one person taking the photo while you're backing away. I mean, I do understand that temptation. But ultimately, you know, in the long term, you want your kids to be able to see that loon. You know, you want to be able to go back to that pond and see that loon again. And so I think there's a good rationale for being cautious in how you do things.
Harry, I also read that loon breeding on our big lakes is way down. But on small lakes, they're having some success in hatching chicks. So what's the difference?
Yeah. So you could have several different types of territories. On lakes that are typically 100 to 300 acres or so in size, the lake essentially becomes a loon territory. So a pair of loons will set up on that lake and they'll defend that entire lake from an intruding pair of loons and claim that as their breeding lake. And those loons often have a little bit less disturbance from other loons. A lot of times those lakes are less busy recreationally. And so those loons tend overall to do a little bit better than loons on the large lakes.
Give us a couple examples of those smaller lakes where loons are doing well.
Sure. So White Oak Pond or Kennesaka are two lakes that are fairly close to the Loon Center in central New Hampshire. Both of those have had good populations of loons. They don't have chicks every year, but loons are a long-lived species. Nobody knows how long exactly, but we figure 25 or 30 years is our best guess at this point is for an average lifespan. And so even if they miss a year, they can cope. They could rebound from that because they can come back next year and try again.
So bigger lakes are more problematic, I'm guessing, because of human activity?
Often it's because of human activity. It's also because you have multiple pairs of loons. And so it's a little bit easier for intrusions into that territory, and that can also disrupt the nesting success of these birds.
Here's an email from John in Wilmot, who says, I work in Canaan, I live in Wilmot, and we've had a boom in loon populations on our local lakes. Little Lake Sunapee, 7 breeding pair, Grafton Pond, 5 pair, and Canaan Street Lake, 5 pair. Wow, John, that sounds amazing, Harry.
Yes, and I would have to dial that back a little bit, because often when people talk about pairs of loons, they are typically talking about one occasion in which they saw 10 loons even together, and sometimes that can happen. But Grafton Pond actually has 3 breeding pairs usually. Canaan Street Lake is really only has 1 breeding pair of loons, but you will get visiting loons coming in as well.
So on these smaller lakes, are loons okay sharing, or it depends on the size? If it's a pretty small lake, maybe even a pond, is it just one pair and nobody else is welcome?
Typically what we found is that lakes up to about 300 acres will usually have only one pair. There are cases where, and a lot of that depends on the shape of the lake as well. If you have a 300-acre round lake, you're probably only going to have one pair of that. But pinch that lake off in the middle, so it's more of a kind of a figure eight shape, and you can easily get a loon setting up on each side of that lake. You can have two territories.
What about, David, lakes with dams? Or, as I understand, some loons actually live on rivers, which I was surprised to learn. What happens to loons when all of a sudden the water level goes up or down?
Yeah, so, you know, I think Harry mentioned this earlier, where we have issues associated with nest sites being flooded out. And certainly, you know, where we have a dam, you know, where we have a water release, that's obviously an issue. And that comes back to this sort of this maladaption and how changes in the environment can often cause problems if the species is not well adapted to those changes. You know, the flip side, and, you know, and Harry can certainly fill in more here, is that, you know, with a dam, we actually have a way of controlling the water level. So if we have a severe rain event, you know, I presume that there's some potential there to actually mitigate that through the control structure, which may not be possible in an entirely natural setting.
Do you want to jump in on that, Harry? Dams.
Yes, we actually work with dam owners throughout the state to let them know if there's a nesting pair of loons on their lakes and to try and maintain stable water levels during those most critical nesting periods.
So sort of 1st of June to mid-July,
yes.
It sounds like.
Yes, and even a little bit on either side of that, because if loons will fail in their first nest, about half the time they'll actually re-nest and try again.
Here's an email that came in from Deb on Lake Sunapee. Last winter, Harry made an incredible rescue of several loons on Sunapee who had gotten iced in. Would he please comment on whether or not this is happening more often, and if so, why? Harry, you're famous. I did not hear about this.
It was a rescue attempt and sadly unsuccessful, in fact, in that. But LPC staff do make several attempts now to rescue loons. And back in 2007, we found 22 loons stranded up on the ice on Winnipesaukee.
And so wait, how does that happen? Because they migrate, right, to the coast in the wintertime.
Right. And loons, because they're so heavy-bodied, they will actually molt all of their wing feathers at the same time. And that leaves them flightless for a period of 3 or 4 weeks in January or February, sometime in that area. They're supposed to do that when they're on the ocean. Because the ocean, at least here, is not going to freeze over, and so they don't need that to have that ability to fly.
So hang on, let me just draw this out for folks. So they're heavy, they've got wings, they're not great at flying, but they do it, they make it to the coast, and then their flight feathers fall out. But that's okay, because they can hang out at the coast for the winter.
Exactly.
So go ahead.
The problem in 2007 was that we had had a record warm early winter, and the broads on Winnipesaukee had stayed open. And so these loons, in their migratory path to the ocean, saw what looked to be essentially an inland ocean. The weather was warm. The fishing was good. They decided to stay for a while on Winnipesaukee.
Oh, they stayed too long.
And when the cold snap finally did happen, it caught them right in the middle of that wing feather molt, and they were unable to leave. And so this is something that we are finding more and more now. And so as our winters are delayed, we're now getting into that danger period where a lot of these lakes aren't freezing over until January or February. And that is what is causing us to have many more of these winter loon rescues.
Wow. So they decide, they make a decision. I'm kind of anthropomorphizing here, but they make a decision at that point. Hey, it's warm. The fishing's good. Let's stay. But biologically, the feathers come out when the feathers are programmed to come out.
Right.
Wow. You know, this relates to an email we just got from Gary, and I'll throw this to you, David. And Gary, thank you for the email. He says, your guests continue to mention climate change as a factor in the lives of the animals you're talking about. How can the individuals working with these animals deal with the impacts of climate change when, Gary says, Governor Sununu, an environmental engineer, denies the impact of carbon and human contribution to climate change? As governor, can't he have an impact on their research and funding? Gary, thank you. And David, what about funding here at the state level for climate research, for anti-climate change efforts, for some of these species impacted by climate change? We hear at the federal level that funding for climate change efforts are going away. What about at the state level?
Yeah, so I mean, certainly, I mean, we always make the argument that more funding is needed. And I think that you know, we've heard, you know, some discussion around whether or not climate change, you know, is a real thing, and that certainly then feeds into what is seen as a priority for funding. I think that what we need to recognize is that, you know, is whether or not climate change is seen as actually happening. The things that we need to do to address climate change make an incredible amount of sense for this state, and I do think that that is something that the governor and absolutely recognizes. So, you know, we want local jobs, we want clean air, we want renewable energy. These things are all beneficial to New Hampshire, and so we can agree on that. And I think that if we're putting our funding towards those areas, then we're obviously getting at the root cause, you know, of climate change as well as really benefiting the state. You know, I also think that when we think about, you know, what we need to do from an ecological standpoint to address issues of climate change, the same thing is true. These activities, you know, benefit people in all sorts of other ways. So, for example, we need clean water to drink. Well, let's protect our watersheds. Well, when we protect our watersheds, we get clean water, we reduce the risk of downstream flooding, and we benefit wildlife habitat as well. You know, we want our lakes to be beautiful places to swim, to recreate, and again, have clean water. Well, let's make sure we maintain a buffer so that we don't get an algal bloom in summer, and that benefits our loons. So there's so much point of agreement, so much point of intersection. You know, the issue of climate change, in many cases, can be set to one side because there is so much to agree on and that we can move forward. And I really do want to emphasize that, you know, focusing on climate change as being sort of this political disagreement and saying, well, because of that, we can't act. I disagree. I think, you know, there's a tremendous amount of opportunity for us to work together across party divides, across some ideological, you know, differences.
Because the work that you do has so many not side benefits, just a plethora of benefits that expand out in a circle. For example, if your local beach is closed to cyanobacteria, bad for your local ice cream shop, bad for, you know, the business that sells, you know, sunscreen and bathing suits because nobody's going to the beach.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we think about the future we want here for, you know, in New Hampshire. And I think we're all here because we love this place. I have two young children. I think about the future that I want them to have. I want them to be able to see loons on the lakes. I want them to be able to drink water out of the tap. You know, I want them to be able to go outside and exercise without an air warning saying that today is, the air quality is so low that you shouldn't go outside. These things are commonalities that I think we can all agree on. And so that's really what drives me and my work, and I think, you know, should drive all of us.
Well, Harry, we're almost close to the end, but I did want to ask about some of the efforts of your many, many, many volunteers to help loon nests be successful. How do you go about that work without disturbing the loons? Because you described earlier, they don't exactly like it when humans are around.
Sure. So we have more than 800 volunteers throughout the state. They contributed more than 6,000 hours to all of our management and monitoring and research efforts. There are a number of different things that these volunteers help us with. So we can float rafts, that helps loons that have been displaced from traditional nesting sites because of shoreline development. It helps loons with on lakes with changing water levels because they float. So they go up and down as these water levels go up and down. We put out signs and rope lines around nesting loons to give them a little bit of the space that they need. And generally, we take our cues from the loons. And so a good rule of thumb is to stay about 150 feet back from loons and give them even more room if they vocalize or show any other signs of stress. So as we're putting signs and rope lines around these loons, we are watching the loon. And the minute it begins to lower its head across the nest, which is a sign of distress for these birds, we back up, you know, 10 or 15 feet from there, and that's where we put our sign and put our rope line so that we have a good sense of these loons. And different loons have different tolerances, but the important thing is to not force them to change their behavior. And so I always want to say there's a lot that we can talk about loons. The two main points that I love to leave people with is if we want to help loons, don't use lead sinkers and jigs and just give them a little bit of space. And that's especially true with loons that are on the nest or loons with chicks.
Well, Harry, it's always good to see you. Thank you very much for
Thank
being
you.
Here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Harry Vogel, Director of the Loon Preservation Committee. By the way, we put on our website a link to Harry's Loon Cam, so you can check it out, nhpr.org/exchange. David Patrick, thank you so much for helping us out.
Thanks so much, Laura.
David Patrick, Director of Conservation for the Nature Conservancy in New Hampshire. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.